From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life.
I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Whether your mental or physical wellness brings you to the top of the highest peaks,
or you need a little help with the climb,
The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch.
Our first guest this morning is Vanessa O'Brien. She's a book author, but that's just her most recent accomplishment. She had a successful career in banking until the recession in about 2009 when she decided to switch gears and step out of her comfort zone. Well, stepping out of our comfort zone might inspire some of us to take up, say, watercolor painting or learning a language. But for Vanessa, she was inspired to become a mountaineer. And not just any mountaineer. She has accomplished a feat that, maybe 1% of 1% in the world have. She's tackled each of the seven summits, as well as the North and South Pole. She joins us to discuss her memoir, To the Greatest Heights, Facing Danger, Finding Humility, and Climbing a Mountain of Truth. Vanessa O'Brien, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Lynn. Hi, Pete.
Great to have you. And boy, our show, The Mountain Life, is really personified by someone like you who has...
What a great title.
Yeah, exactly. I know, we can barely lay claim to it, even though we live in a mountain town. But let's start with, your book is sort of the result of all of these journeys you've been on, really all of your life, which culminated in being part of that revered and very small group of people, the Explorers Grand Slam, all seven summits, the North and South Pole. And you weren't a mountaineer really at all until about, 2010?
That's right. Yeah, no, I there was no mountaineering whatsoever. It just, there was a catalyst. The catalyst was the recession in 2008-09. And I was just looking for something to do, and it could have been anything at that point in time. And somebody sort of blurted out the words Everest, and it sort of fell on the floor like a penny bouncing on the floor and ricocheting off the top. And I thought, wow, Everest, Everest, where is it? Like, how high is it? I remember it had been summited or reading about it being summited in 1953 by Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, but it was also being climbed now or then in 2010. And, the question was, could I do it? And could I train for it? Could I learn all of these things? And would I be any good at it? Would I like it?
Hmm.
I guess I saw climbing as a skill rather than a barrier to entry just because I didn't know how.
So one of the things you talk about is not that you're an adrenaline junkie or you seek out risky activities, but you're very goal-oriented. And you must come with just a boatload of self-confidence. You were inspired by these three words. I think it's speed, simplicity, and self-confidence. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because you have to have a lot of self-confidence to, I think, in your 40s, start to say, maybe I'll just go climb Everest.
Yeah, absolutely. Self-confidence is very important. And, how one gets that is sort of an interesting sociological study, in a sense. Mm-hmm. That those three things came to me via a training program at GE, at General Electric. And Jack Welch, who has now passed, but was an amazing CEO and business leader. And he really, if you break each one of those down, they're very, very simple. But they all talk about something that's important in business, but they can be transferred really to lots of different things. So speed, is something that helps business. When is it better to go slower than faster? In many senses, of course, if you're a heart surgeon or something like that, you might want to slow down. It could be technical, and you don't want to get something wrong. But in most cases, efficiency, productivity, you know, requires some amount of speed. You don't want to prolong things. You want to just, you know, kind of get it over with. And that certainly helped in the mountain, because the mountain is dangerous. And there's crevasses, there's avalanches, there's all sorts of, you know, points of differentiation where you want to, you know, try to get in and get out in the most efficient way. So speed is very important. Simplicity, when is it better to make things more complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Almost never. You always, always, always want to make sure that, you know, you keep things as simple as possible. And when you can do that, communication is open and people are able to understand what they have to do, and that also aids in simplicity. Self-confidence is sort of the third leg of that, and that comes a little bit with experience, that comes with trial and error, and that is something that will also give you the ability to go forward, you know, and be able to tackle things easier. Self-confidence comes, I always say when I'm talking to audiences, especially young audiences, to start with self-confidence with something that you know to be true. Like you always know how you feel. So you can always be confident about how you feel, right? So start with something you know, and then as you build experience, then become more confident with facts, become more confident with the things that you know, and build your confidence. But it can start with looking somebody in the eye. It can start with what used to be a firm handshake. Now maybe it's an elbow, you know, who knows in the days of COVID, right? But confidence is when you look somebody in the eye and you say, I understand, I got this, and even if you're 99 or 98% sure, you can sometimes work out those details, knowing that, you know, you have enough of that brief to sort of fill in the gaps as you go.
Vanessa, your story is powerful, and I'm going to kind of piggyback on your self-confidence point. Many of us would make any kind of transition from a work experience and losing our jobs to, hey, I'm going to go climb Everest as a big jump and not building that confidence. Share with our listeners on how did you gain that confidence and experience to make that jump?
Sure. So in my case, making the jump from, say, the business world to the natural world, if I can call it that, the first thing I did was go and learn how to climb. So I learned what all these what all that climbing kit was, right? What is a harness? What are the crampons? And I went over to Fox Glacier, which is in New Zealand, and I learned how to climb. So the interesting point is, and you see this in the book, which is basically broken down into three chapters. The first is the pursuit of Everest. In the pursuit of Everest, I take the reader with me as I learn to climb. And I'm literally Googling Everest in the book, right? And I'm breaking down like just some of these high-level pieces of equipment in the most kind of funny way. The book is quite funny. But like, you know, what are these things that you put on your feet? And, you know, why are they there and how they can go wrong? And as ridiculous as it is, like you can watch a million tutorials on crampons and they'll never tell you which is left and which is right. And you know, there's some really, really funny sort of, you know, things around that. But the most important thing is when I do my very first test to go on a mountain after learning how to climb, I do meet failure. And this is so important for me and for even others to acknowledge that can happen. And what I learn about that process is there's some really important reasons why the failure happens. And I look at that, I clock all the different reasons why the failure takes place, and I own it. I own it, I eat the humble pie, it makes me a better climber, and I do it almost like as a rewind when I'm coming down the mountain. I'm rewinding like everything that I've clocked that I've done wrong. And then I go back and I incorporate those things and do them differently. But I also learn that failure becomes a data point.
Right.
And that you can't fail unless you give up. And that's such a powerful message. I learn it more later than that first Everest one, because it takes 3 years for me to climb K2, more because of climate and other idiosyncrasies. But it's really, really important that people don't look at failure as, oh, no, it's the end, you know, or it's just me and I'm crap. You know, that they have to look at that failure and say, okay, what did I learn? Fantastic, check. You know, I got that.
That's
and,
so
and that
true.
You're never really out until you put up the white flag and say, you know, I'm out and I give up.
Yeah, and it's ironic that we, you know, we focus in the, you know, even your book focuses on the seven summits. You know, so many of us in life are so focused on the peaks, these moments of exhilaration and success. But all of us know that in order to achieve those successes, we have to have failure. We have to embrace these moments of our own reality, our own humanity. And your text and your story really highlights that. Was there, and I think of moments where, whether it's, you know, teaching my kids how to ski and they're safe failures, you want to accept,
yeah.
You don't want to have that failure when you're on K2, you know? Was there kind of one standout moment for you as you were going through this journey where there was a failure where maybe at the moment you didn't love it, but now you're so appreciative specifically of it?
Well, that one for sure, because if I didn't fail there and then early, I don't think I would have had the deep philosophical sense of, you know, why I needed to change some of the things I needed to change. You know, that what's great about failure, and this is true of almost anything, is it if you're aware, it shows you what you can do different. The problem with instant success is it tells you not to change anything.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's the problem, is success says the formula is correct, do nothing different. And that's awful in a way, because that's stagnant. Nothing changes in success. But failure at least says, wow, okay, how can I tamper with this? What can I do differently? How can I make it better? And you're never really making success better, because it's working.
Yeah.
And that's why, in a way, failure is great, because you're always, you know, sort of, you know, at the margin, you know, trying to say, how can I make it better? You know, what can I do with the equipment, the supplies, the oxygen, the team, there's so many little things that you can, you know, tamper with, even the medication, you know, making sure that, you know, you have, you know, the right doses for the right number of people, you know, just everything, learning about the body's ability to acclimatize, build the red blood cells. You know, there's just so many things, but the failure is absolutely important. And sometimes, you know, if people haven't, now I'm thinking of something completely different, but, you know, I remember the first time whitewater rafting and taking my husband, who is not outdoorsy at all, and the rapids were getting more and more, you know, class 3, 4, 5. And as it was getting more and more dangerous, I looked, there was just four of us, and I looked at the main guide, and we looked at each other, and it was like, yep, let's toss him. He's got to go over now.
Awesome.
Because he's got to know what to do.
Yeah.
If he doesn't go feet first, straight down, and he panics in the wrong place, we're in trouble. And it's kind of that, it's that tough love, right? Like, you know, it sounds awful, but, you know, I think of that moment and I laugh a little bit, but, you know, it's like what you're saying on the skiing, right? Where it's safe, fall.
Yeah.
But you don't want to do it where it's going to hurt and it's going to damage or kill somewhere later.
So many of us let failure just completely defeat us. And we won't reach out afterwards, you know, if we have a particularly, maybe it has a lot to do with ego. And it's interesting as you were talking, because I was thinking that mountaineers must have, you know, must have some sizable egos. And for you to talk as you do about the humility and the learning from your mistakes and failure being a data point, that you, it sounds like you have overcome that ego.
Yeah, you know, there's a great book. It was Benjamin Hardy, and it was Personality Isn't Permanent. I think it goes on to say a few more things after that. But
we love him. We interviewed him. Yeah.
Okay, great. So in his latest book, I open his chapter as a subject. And he says that's exactly what happens, is if during all of these trials and tribulations, because the seven summits were 295 days, and I basically lived on a mountain for a year. And I had gone through such intense situations, and it's so hard to explain, but, you know, I couldn't just negotiate my way out of these things, right? It was like pure survival. And he says that my ego just completely cracked open.
That's great.
And it was only then that, you know, I did, in fact, start to listen to the mountains and learn patience and learn that I couldn't control everything. Because in business, you know, you're hired to control everything. You are, you know, whatever you are, insert title here, right?
Yes.
And you control. But in the mountain, you cannot control everything. And if you think you do, Mother Nature will soon and very quickly make that point of view change. And it's a great way to, you know, test power against power, but you cannot go against Mother Nature. You will lose. So you are humbled over and over and over again. And until you relinquish, in a way, control and start to become one, if you will, with nature, and really start to, you know, identify. And now it, you know, it sounds more, you know, almost spiritual, but you have to, you know, exist with nature and try to understand, you know, the signs and the warnings and, you know, as much guidance as she, the mountain, you know, Gaia, the planet will allow you and tell you.
And so many of us, Vanessa, are really like embracing that as, you know, mountain town enthusiasts. And we have a lot of new locals who've escaped from California or their other destinations, and they're learning that lesson even here. And I had a great conversation yesterday with my in-laws who were in town, and all of us, not some of us who have been here for many years, were thrown off by the snow after a 70-degree day in Park City. And there was an element of, you know, ugh, it's ruined my day. It's horrible. And I turned to him. I said, this is what the mountains teach us. You know, mountains have lessons for us, and we're not in control, and how much we need to let go. And, you know, if we need to change our schedule, that's okay. You know, these obstacles are opportunities for us. And, that's a big walk away for many of us who do live in the mountains, is the mountains are, very real.
Yep, and they're unpredictable, and that's and they're volatile. But you learn to work within that, and over time you will appreciate it. You know, as much as sometimes it can be annoying, it's you know, hopefully you'll start to recognize patterns, and that's where, you know, there's some intelligence that will come from that. But still, always unpredictable. Never can you pretend to, you know. to forecast that with 100% accuracy.
Right. And for those who are listening, if you've been new to the area, it will snow until June.
That's right. Vanessa, I wanted to switch gears a bit and ask you about this story that you tell early on in the book about, I think it's your second attempt at K2. And I mean, from everything I know about K2, it's like the deadliest mountain. Just a phenomenal mountain. I'll never forget back in about the early 2000s, seeing the movie and reading the story, The Women of K2, and thinking about all the fatalities on K2 and thinking, I would never want to do that. And on this trip, you open up with a story about a woman who has lost her husband and son on K2. And she asks you to look for any trace of them, because most people get buried by avalanches and are never really, I mean, a lot of people are not found again. Why did you start with that story, and how did that, I mean, how did you want to continue?
Yeah, you know, it's, first, I will say on every large mountain, you know, unfortunately, it is true, you know, that, you know, if there are deaths there, and you know, the mountain tends to keep those that die there. You know, it's hard to remove people if they die on mountains. You know, so mountains tend to have, you know, secrets, and those secrets tend to be those that have died over the years, especially earlier, because, you know, there was less ability to retrieve them. Now, of course, technology has gotten a little bit better, but never 100%. And that story is interesting to me for several different reasons. One is both the wife and the mother and the sister and the daughter asked me separately if I could look and see if I could find anything. And part of why that became so important was because the prior year there had thought to have been a sighting. Mm-hmm. So it became more urgent because they thought that there had been a sighting, and so for this particular family, it was more urgent because they thought that they had seen something. And in fact, one of them even went to Pakistan to do a DNA sample. Mm. So, and I know, having lost a brother, at least, you know, for a couple of days being drowned, that when there is no body, it's very, very hard for loved ones to ever really come to terms with death, because there is no, there's no, it's like the person leaves and they never come home. And there's no funeral, there's no sign of death. So all they remember is life. And it's just psychologically hard to process death when you just see somebody walk out the door and never come back. And it's true for war, it's true for so many other things besides mountains, but when you don't have a proper burial, and you never process it for full circle.
I didn't finish the story. You saw these two boots sticking out of the snow. And you found,
that's right. That's right. And so when they ask me, and it's very unusual to see two boots. So the fact that I see two next to each other, it compels me to take samples, because of course it could be them. Now, they apparently were in an avalanche at Camp 3 on K2, so they would have been together in a tent. Now, for two boots to come all the way down from, say, roughly 25,000 feet, all the way down in the same place and land in the same place together is just so, so highly improbable, right? But because they're there together, I think, I've got to do it. I've got to take the samples. And to take the samples means a little bit of the bone, a little bit of the tissue. And, you know, if you can imagine, maybe there is a foot in a boot, and then it's snapped, you know, it's sort of the tibia or between the knee and the rest of the foot or the ankle. Mm-hmm. And they're different color boots. So when I'm texting her, I say, were they wearing this brand of boots? And she doesn't come back to me, so I take the sample. And then when I get back with the sample, and I'm going to put it on ice, and she says, no, they weren't wearing that brand of boots. And I think, oh.
Well, you'll help someone else find their loved one and have closure.
Well, you can't. You can't, because it has to be an exact DNA match.
Oh, wow.
So
you'd think there would be a stockpile of DNA
before
saved.
You go?
Yeah, well that, no, that somehow the family would, you know, take a strand of hair from a hairbrush or, you know, something after their loved one disappears on K2.
I know. You know, it's really, that would be a great idea, actually. Not a bad idea at all. You know, because later in the book, you know, somebody gives me, on my third attempt, a ring to bring to the top. And I find, of course, an arm, a woman's arm with a ring. And it reminds me of my own mortality. Oh. Like, will I be the one to die and leave the ring?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
Man. Well, Vanessa, it is a pleasure and an honor and a little grotesque but beautiful to speak with you. And many of us, including some of our listeners who are texting in, are saying we're really glad that we don't have to do DNA tests on our trails here and find feet and arms. It's really an honor. Vanessa's book is To the Greatest Heights, Facing Danger, Finding Humility, and Climbing a Mountain of Truth. Thank you for joining us, Vanessa.
Okay, thank you guys. Have a great day.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Mountain Life.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe, rate us, and leave us a comment.
If you have an idea for a future show, email us at mountainlife@kpcw.org.
We hope you'll bring your green smoothie and join us next week for The Mountain Life.